RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
Hello, and welcome to another World of UX podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thanks for taking the time to join us on today. And as always, I like to take special time to greet those who are listening for the very first time. Today, we're going to air part two of a conversation that I had with Karen Lynn. Very enlightening, very energetic conversation. I love what my guests bring to the table. Great stuff that people need to hear in this age where there's all types of information all over the place and lots of misinformation. I'm very happy and proud to bring you something that's important to hear, something that's needful to hear. And today, in this session where we actually had to cut ourselves, we were going to cover four questions. We ended up just covering three, but we're going to cover a topic that's very near and dear to Karen's heart, and that is something called tech supremacy. We hear about all types of different supremacy. This one's a little different, so stick around so you can hear what Karen is going to refer to and what she means by tech supremacy. Ready? Let's go ahead and dive in. Topic number three, and we get to speed up now because these are mostly Karen topics. So Darren gets to be quiet for the most part on some of these. Sure. How does tech supremacy play out in the workplace? Now, I know you got to explain what tech supremacy is for some folks.
Yeah, so I guess just to back up a little bit, IAC 22 was this past summer. I submitted a poster session for it that got accepted. And really the premise was the question that I wanted to pose to the participants was how does supremacy play out in the tech industry? Whether it's in the workplace or, you know, whether we see it as end users of technology systems, apps, websites, whatever it is, whatever the technology might be. I mean, even transportation, right? Could be, that's a technology. And I just wanted people to start thinking about how we see that play out in the workplace. How does that affect us? How do we sometimes play into that notion that, you know, tech is supreme to everything and could do no wrong? And primarily this is actually like a theory just a theory that I've been tossing around in my head around supremacy and the different types of supremacy systems that harm, you know, they harm victims, but then they also uphold abusers. Mm-hmm. And where do we see, where, like, you know, each of us, we have a role in that, particularly as UX professionals working in and with tech companies. Where do we sit in all of that? And so that was a question that I was just trying to, I just wanted to pose to the people at the conference, hear what their thoughts are, what they've seen happen. And I suspected that we all have stories where we've seen this happen. So I just wanted to get, you know, create a space to get that out into the open. It was an experiment. I'll have to say it was a very interesting experiment. I'm actually thinking of doing more of those sessions and how to do that to get more people in our field, particularly to think about it. I'll say it really depends. Okay, let me think about this. How do I want to say this? There is a cultural aspect to tech supremacy. We grew up surrounded by technology in some form or another. Mm-hmm. We've all been swept up and caught up in the latest wave of technological advancement. And there really is no getting away from it per se, right? We participate in some way and we benefit in some way, right? And that's what keeps systems of supremacy in play and intact, is when enough people support it, enough people are willing to give abusers the benefit of the doubt. They're willing to be sympathetic to those abusers.
Yep.
And they're also willing to turn a blind eye or to not, to look the other way, right? When victims of that system are harmed and be like, oh, well, you know, it's because you did something wrong, right? Then that's where the blaming and shaming comes in, right? And if you think about it, like I said, you know, all systems of supremacy work in a very similar way. Mm-hmm. And so you can hopefully start to see how this plays out, not only in technology, but, you know, just think about all the other supremacist issues we're facing in current day politics right around the world. So anyway, I'm trying to think of what I think this would be maybe a more interesting conversation to hear from a group of people in some other format, right? Like what those examples are that come to mind for people in a personal way. But Darren, do you have anything? Does anything come to mind for you when it comes to tech supremacy in particular?
It does. The first thing that comes to mind for me when I think about tech supremacy as it pertains to UX is today's proliferation of dark patterns. There's technology that we're dealing with. We're in a position where if we demonstrate the empathy that we should, when we are user-centered instead of stakeholder-centered, somebody just said that recently. I didn't come up with that. I love stakeholder-centered design as a concept because that's a lot of what's going on today. That a lot of product design, that's what it is. It's stakeholder-centered design. It's not user-centered design. And I got my
shareholder.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
Shareholder-centered design.
That too, yes. I went and got my car washed today. Didn't know it was going to come into play with this. I pull up. You can put your credit card in. Slide in, pick your wash, whatever. This interface was designed in a way, and I even said it, and the person, the attendant, didn't know what I was talking about. I said, this thing is full of dark patterns. I'm trying to get my car washed, and I'm doing UX work and evaluating because I could not figure out how to pick my car wash. But if you went the way that it appeared you needed to go, you ended up signing up for a monthly car wash membership. So the dark pattern was it cast this web and it that whole bait and switch type of thing where, okay, I just want a wash. I want to get it waxed today because the pigeons have had a field day on my cars. I need to get my car washed. I don't know, like a sign said, poop on me, something. So that's what it seemed like. So I wanted to get my car washed, but I can't. I ended up calling for the attendant because I can't figure this out. And the way that it, when I pressed on one thing and put my card in, it was taking me down some road and it was talking as if I was signing up for something. I'm not signing up for anything. I just want that $13 wash. I don't want a $24 a month membership. Then they tell their people to come out and try to sell everybody. I said, don't you want to get the membership? You know, if you sign up, you get 2 free months. So everything is geared at trying to get as many people to sign up. They probably get a bonus or some extra money when people sign up. I said, no, because I'm not going to get any value out of it. You get 2 months free. Free doesn't move me at all. I just want a car wash. Can I just get a car wash? And then she finally pushed the buttons and she knew how to get through it. But I could not figure it out. So here's this thing where the people who have the technology have the power. The people who have the technology have the power, and they're exercising tech supremacy by just as it with other types of supremacy. People are in power, they control things, and they are void of empathy. Completely void of empathy, and they do their thing, and until somebody gets up and stops them or stands up or calls it out, it will continue going that way. So yeah, so that's the example that come to mind for me.
Yeah, and actually that is a very real thing, right? That the more power someone has, the less empathy that they have for others, right? So yep. that there's a catch 22 there, right? We all want to be wildly successful million billionaires or whatever it is, but you know, there is a downside to that. Yep. Right, in our ability to empathize and have compassion for other people. And I first learned about this research in Andrew Yang's book, Forward, because he's all about, okay, how do we think about or rethink about democracy to actually be really about and for the people?
Yep.
And, you know, not let it be hijacked by people who want to just control everything.
Yeah.
And you know, sort of force them, literally force their way on everybody else. And the other thing that I'll say about that, about supremacy, is there's also one of the biggest but most invisible byproducts of supremacy is erasure.
So think about
that, you know, Darren, think about that example that you just gave about the car wash, right? Like you couldn't make heads or tails of how to just get the thing that you needed done.
Yep.
If it were not for that attendant that happened to be there, like, can you imagine, right? If you were in a situation, no one was there to help you figure it out. How are you going to get that car wash? You probably just wouldn't. Exactly. And that is that, unfortunately, is what has historically happened with every wave of technological advancement. We've left people behind. Yep. And that was in Andrew Yang's other book.
The Digital Divide.
Yeah, we leave people behind. Yep. And but you know, in the name of quote unquote progress. Right? And then we have to think about, well, progress for who, really? and who not for, right? Like these are all invisible to those of us who are lucky enough for now to be on the winning side of these systems.
Yep. Just consider those folks collateral damage.
Yeah. Right. But hopefully as UX professionals, we're able to extend our skills and empathy and compassion for end users to see these things that are happening.
Yes. Yes. We have 2 topics left, but we're running out of time.
Right.
So I'm gonna call out one more topic, and we'll save the other one for another time.
Sure.
And so today we're gonna wrap up by talking about UX leadership, and specifically the question is the rhetorical question, which you're gonna answer. It's not very rhetorical. It's rhetorical for a moment. Where in the world is the CXO? Where is the Chief Experience Officer? So take it away, Karen.
Yeah, so my understanding, having just trying to do a little bit of research on my own on this topic, is that they're given the establishment of our UX industry and how old our industry is now, you would think at this point there would be more prominence in this role at companies, right? That the more and more companies would realize, hey, you know, our systems, our products are becoming more and more complex. We need someone to be accountable for making sure the experience overall across all of our channels, all of our products make sense and are consistent. You know, because all of these things affect our reputation and our brand as a company and the way people engage with us. What I wanted to say about this and what I was hoping to give a talk about this at Debbie Levitt's Concentric Conference was to talk about my own experience having had that title at a SaaS pre-A seed stage SaaS startup, where I was able to have that oversight on our entire product portfolio, including everything that was all of our back office systems, anything that anyone touched and that we had to build ourselves. I was able to take a very human-centered approach to prioritization and figuring out, okay, well, who are the different audiences and what is the need? And to look at it from the overall experience of the entire company's product portfolio inside and out. So I was very lucky to have a little bit of a peek into that. And including how we made decisions to fix or not fix or to build or not build certain features. Also based off of what is the experience when we choose not to do something due to limited resources, what is the experience otherwise for end users, our B2C end users, if we can't resolve the issue for them in a technology, right? With a technical fix. How else do we make things right? How else do we reconcile the problem? And then continue to keep track and monitor, you know, is this a growing problem? Is this affecting more and more people? And then therefore requiring more and more urgency to prioritize or not? And what I learned, from this, and my hypothesis now for why we have not seen more and more CXO roles is because most companies might not be at that level of complexity yet. Like, they're not feeling the pain point yet. I won't say that they're not feeling it. I don't think they're aware of their pain point. It's one of those situations that people are so used to doing things in a particular way, and just, you know, the thing about usability and why I say like usability is a myth, right, is that the truth is, as humans, we're actually very highly adaptable creatures, and as a species, right, we can bend over backwards for a lot of different things, whether or not it's harmful to us is a separate question.
Yeah.
We can. My point is, we can absorb a lot of negative design, right? It's bad design. We can absorb it. We can deal with it. Every time I go, just to give a crass example, every time I go to a restroom that has like the motion sensor flush and it flushes when I don't want it to flush, but then yeah, I have no control over it.
Right.
Am I in a position to say, no, I'm going to avoid using this bathroom? No, I have to deal with it. Right? Yep. I have to make do, right? I'm not going to, you know, go searching another 20 minutes when I need to use the bathroom to use this bathroom. So as humans, we will put up with a lot. What I suspect is that there actually are a lot of pain points that companies are feeling as a result of all this complexity, particularly if you're a company that has B2C and B2B products, right? If you're a multi-sided business model, mm-hmm. This is actually a very critical issue that I've seen get swept under the rug. One of those. and oftentimes what happens in that particular case is that you have one, either the B2C side pillaging the B2B side, or the B2B side pillaging the B2C, because the model itself is not balanced.
Right.
So I think we will see a greater and greater need for this. The wise companies that are in the multi-channel, omni-channel, multi-sided market space, right, with lots of different digital channels. So like if they have, you have the native apps, you have, the website, the .com, maybe you have IoT devices as part of, a service channel delivery system, right? If I think these companies are the ones who should be looking more closely at the pain points that they are dealing with due to the complexity of all these different systems and different audiences that they have to serve at the same time. So my hope is in getting this message out there more and more, that more companies will start to wisen up to the fact that, okay, they really do need to invest in looking into a CXO role specifically dedicated to looking at and being accountable for that experience holistically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I hope we start seeing more of it. But we're approximately 20 years in on this trip. Technically 25, about 25 years in, going back to the IA days, not going back to Don Norman's days, because it wasn't adopted. User experience practices were not that popular, or the need wasn't acknowledged until the late 90s. And the dot-com bust, I like to say, is what really, when things really started to explode after that. So I constantly say that we're roughly 20 years in. And so, yeah. And until UXers start to communicate, I call it speaking exec, until we start to speak in the terms that leadership understands, instead of always using our terminology, it's going to be an even slower trek. So I wish people, I talked about that at an event in California back in 2015, 2016. I spoke at the UX Strategy Summit and I brought that up, haven't seen it happen very much since then.
Yeah, so. which is surprising, but also concerning, right? Because I have a feeling what's happening is some of that erasure that we were talking about, mm-hmm. right? Because it's so invisible, it's easy to just look at the data and be like, oh, well, there's more clicks or more people are spending more time in the app. That's a good thing, right? But again, the what, without really understanding the why behind the what, it is very easy to fall into the trap of thinking like, oh, well, more is better, right? Yeah. But the reality is like, well, people are just lost in her app, or they can't figure out what to do. That's why they're spending more time, right? Or you're entrapping them, we were saying earlier, with the pictures and the visuals. Yep. When at the end of the day, it has absolutely nothing to do with what people are really trying to accomplish.
Yep. Vanity metrics are ruling the day. People are misdefining UX, redefining UX, trying to oversimplify it, fill UX roles with people who have absolutely no idea what they're doing and no interest in even getting better at what they're doing. I actually had an engagement with Lou Rosenfeld today on LinkedIn, one of the authors of the Polar Bear book. And he was talking about the certain state of what's happening with UXers in Nigeria, specifically called out Nigeria. And I responded, I thought I should chime in And I said, the interesting thing about what he said, I wished him well. I said, I hope you do a good job accomplishing some things with these people, because I've actually been interacting with people around the world for the past 11 to 12 years. Many of them have been in Africa. But the thing I called out was the same things that you listed, your bullet points, those same problems are here in the States too. We're not further along than the same problems that we talk about. If we go to a coffee house locally and talk about some of the challenges being faced in UX, I can talk to people in Germany, Scandinavia, South Africa, Italy, Texas, Japan, you name it. Everybody who cares about UX and is really trying to do the right things in UX, and even people that aren't, people that are brand new, everybody's talking about the same exact issues. Whether it's he talked about the people that are that jobs are so scarce that they're basically engaging in character assassination to get jobs. They're willing to step on other people in order to get ahead. I'm going, that happened to me, you know. So I wasn't in Nigeria. It happened to me. So and I don't know if anybody reading that is going to catch what I said. But and I will say this too, and I love all the pioneers, but the pioneers were not vocal about this, about these things that are now an issue. And when I first started saying that UX was under siege in 2011, everybody told me that I was crazy and told me to shut up. And now what are we dealing with? The offspring of the siege. The siege was a seed when I called it out. Now it's several trees and the fruit is falling everywhere. And now we're in a position where we have to counter what's being done. We're not just identifying it anymore. We have to counter it, or the same thing that happened when I was in instructional design is going to happen to the UX. I'll be retired and gone and over there sitting in a rocking chair somewhere saying, see, I told you, because I won't be here to deal with it. I keep telling people, but we gotta, and I'll get you close up with the closing remarks here. We'll wrap up here.
I just wanted to add to that, right? Like, I haven't seen these comments on LinkedIn yet, but the same things are true in the U.S. if we're willing to be honest.
Yes, there you go.
And the fact that we're not always willing to be honest, mm-hmm, is an indicator to me that there's another type of supremacy happening here.
Bingo.
Right? And namely, some combination of American tech supremacy, right? Yes, there is. That, you know, we think the problems that we see in other countries are because they're not American or they're not us or somehow we're better, but the reality is we're not better. Yeah. We're just not willing to take a closer, harder look at ourselves.
Yep. Reminds me of my Medium post about the nail in your tire. There's a nail in your tire, and lately I've enhanced that. There's a nail in you have a Lamborghini, and there's a nail in your tire. If you don't take care of that nail in your tire, there is a possibility that you're not going to be able to celebrate that Lamborghini for very much longer, or anything else for that matter, very much longer, if that tire blows and you're on the freeway demonstrating how fast your Lamborghini is. If there's a nail in your tire, it is critically important that we identify it. Where and look for the nails. I'm looking for nails in the tire. So in my own life, in my own career, so that I can tend to it. And a lot of people, when you point out nails in your tire, you're the bad guy now, because you showed somebody there's a nail in your tire. So yeah, people do need to be honest, which is sad, because
it is.
Ethics.
I think it's comical.
It is. That's why I made a comic strip now, talking about all these same things.
Yeah, there you go. It's like, how could I possibly have a nail in my tire? I drive a Lamborghini. That doesn't happen to Lamborghinis.
Right.
That would be Lamborghini supremacy to think that something as basic
Bingo.
of a nail in your tire. That happens to everybody. Like, can't possibly happen.
Yep.
Like, you're just, yeah, that's just beyond beyond denial at that point.
Yes, and that's another key word. There's a lot of denial. And what am I denying? Help me to see what I don't see. There's always a blind spot. It doesn't have to be glaring, but there's always something. But the more you look for it, the better of a chance you have that you'll find it. And when you find it, then now that you know what it is, now you can find a remedy for it. Maybe it is a nail in your tire. Maybe there's a leak in your radiator. Maybe your brake line is, maybe you have a leakage in your brake line, you know, whatever, sticking with the automobile metaphors. But how many times have we had something wrong with our car? Until we take it in to somebody who knows, we never find out what it is. We just know that it's not performing the way that it should. And all those metaphors lend themselves to us tremendously. So I encourage people all the time. I know we're going to wrap up here. I encourage people all the time. That EQ thing, it's so critical. We got to be as self-aware as we can possibly be. Not like when I delivered a talk on emotional intelligence and a riot ensued at the end of it. Because it was a room full of people that didn't want to be aware that there was a nail in their tire. And they got mad at the messenger, so they wanted to hang me from the streetlight pole, and it was done, and accused me of pushing books because I was getting commission from Amazon. I don't get commission from books off Amazon. I recommended the books because if you want to learn more about emotional intelligence, here's some books I recommend. You must be getting paid. You know, they wanted me dead. And these are people say that UXers. That was the thing I almost forgot. Ethics is at the core of this discipline, I found out. At a certain point in my career, I found out ethics is at the core, especially when you consider the fact that no matter what work you're doing, who you're doing the work for, there's always one person or a group of people that either do not trust you or do not see your relevance. And it's not the wireframes that are going to get you a seat at that table. It's not your prototypes. It's not your research. It's your ethics. That's what's going to win them over eventually. And so when I realized that, I just exalted ethics from a standpoint of doing this work, that when you have to earn trust, ethics is at the core of that. When you want people to listen to you and give you a seat at the table, ethics is at the core of that. They're not going to give you a seat at the table because, oh man, your portfolios or your prototype sure was great. No, you won them over because you did something relevant and you respected them. A lot of things tied to ethics. So that's what I found. And if we can't face who we are, there's an ethics problem. If we want to engage in character assassination, there's an ethics problem. And when you want to sit up there and you know that you only have 5 minutes of UX experience, but you want to, somebody told you to go out there and make yourself heard. So now you're trying to develop a following. That's not ethical. That's not ethical. Stop trying to get people to, I told somebody a couple of weeks ago, if you're telling people about Jacob Nielsen's heuristics piece, don't extract his thoughts, put it together with your visuals, mention him at the end, and then also say, hey, if you make sure you don't miss anything that I share, make sure you follow me. This was all about you. And I told the person, this is all about you. And the person kept dancing around and coming up with a bunch of excuses. Well, I did mention Jacob Nielsen. Dude, when you do things, when you say something that somebody else said to avoid plagiarism, you cite the source on the spot, not at the end. You cite it on the spot. You are the star of this presentation. Jacob Nielsen is not. I said, why don't you just send him a link to the post about it from his site? Wouldn't that be fine? Hey, I found this great day. Check this out. No, because you had to be at the center of it. And the person kept making excuses. I block people in a heartbeat. When I see somebody's not ethical, I'm done. I'm done. Because you can't get through to those people. So, anyway, that's my closing rant. What closing rant do you have?
No, actually, as you as you were sharing that example, I was like, oh, is UX bootlegging a term? Like,
that's good.
Like this, sounds like that's what some people are taking it upon themselves to do. Mm-hmm. But is that really what you want to be about at the end of the day? Is that what you want to be known for? Right. And I would hope the answer is no, but if you're looking to make a quick buck, then maybe that is your answer. You know, I mean, to each their own. But then I would challenge that person to think about, well, is this even what you really want to be doing?
Yeah.
Maybe you should figure out what your real passions are and go do that instead.
Yeah.
Instead of
other people's work. Yeah. There's a lot of them want to be celebrities.
Just a thought.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but good stuff. As always, I think we both went a little longer. I think neither one of us thought we were going to go this long, but it's always great to speak to you. Thanks again for sharing. Again, we'll cover that other topic another time. Maybe we spend another whole show talking about it, just that one thing, because that's a big topic, the other thing that you mentioned. But folks, if you're not already connected to or following Karen Lynn on LinkedIn, connect to her out there. You can find her stuff out on Medium as well. Find people like Karen that have something worth listening to. Don't just embrace people because they're talking about UX, because a lot of people are talking about UX and they're selling snake oil and they're going to do it at your expense. So connect to people that really have your best interests at heart and they don't see you in their pocket because that's what a lot of people are doing. But I mean, we keep saying it, not too many people listen to us, but that's okay. If only a few people listen, that's fine. That's fine. So, and we'll live with that.
If we convince one person per per time that we have record these conversations, that's fine in my book. And
absolutely.
And Darren, thank you so much for being that voice of reason and putting yourself out there like tirelessly. I don't know how you do it, but thank you for doing it, because then I feel like, you know, I don't have to do it as much. I'm trying. That's great that you're putting yourself out there and getting the message out there and helping the rest of us navigate our way.
God knows there's times I've wanted to stop and I just can't. I have tried and I see things. I saw instructional design destroyed. I witnessed it. And today instructional design is it is a semblance of its former self, only a shell. That's it. It's only a shell of its former self. You ever been to a training session and walked away and said, I didn't learn a single solitary thing? That's because instructional design, it got bastardized back in the early 2000s. And when that started happening, it became nothing. So now it's 2022. Any of you out there, if you've ever been to training and like, but we weren't trained. All the person did was read PowerPoint slides, or we didn't really, I heard them talking, but I didn't really learn anything. That's because instructional design it's gone. You know, there are a very few people that still practice it, but most don't. UX is headed in the same direction. If people like me, people like Karen, people like Debbie Levitt, people like Dr. Nick, the people like Joel Barr, people like Tony Moore, there are people who care and represent the discipline. Dr. Giles Morrison, people who represent the discipline properly, and there's not that many of us. We are in the gross minority. We say something on LinkedIn or social media, it doesn't get traction. Not really. Even when it gets traction, it doesn't get traction. Somebody else will say something completely ridiculous and they'll get like 10,000 likes and they said nothing. So that's the problem we have. We'll continue to, as I like to say, try to get the water wheel to go in the other direction, do whatever we can. But again, I'm not doing this for me, because by the time we get somewhere that'll be worth having arrived at, I will have retired. So I'm not even doing this for me. But people don't even realize that. So it is what it is.
Well, the lesson here, just to close us out, is doing the ethical thing is never the easy thing.
Bingo. Absolutely.
That's how you know you're doing the ethical thing, right? If it were easy. If it's yep. too easy, then that should already be like a hint that it's probably not ethical.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, folks. But thanks again, Karen. We appreciate it. That is all Thank the you. Time we have for today, folks. So until next time, this is Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX, wishing everybody the best. Happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.